And now, the thrilling continuation of the SML podcast.
Originally, it was English, and then later it was history. Although, when I say history, I mean I was just getting like 4-inch stacks of notes from the actual teacher
and then
running off of those. So, like, I by no means want to overqualify my ability in it. I mean, I love history, but I'm like functionally a dilettante when it came to being a teacher.
My 4 years teaching in the military was my favorite, but I do understand when I go into teaching high school level, I can't look at a student and say, are you fucking retarded or are you just hungover?
My wife is torturing me. She left the room and left Grey's Anatomy on. Like, it's muted, but I could still see it out of the corner of my eye.
So you have this uncomfortable erection now.
On that note...
Dr. Grey.
Joe married a nurse, so he has that Pavlovian response. He scrubs, he just gets a boner.
Pretty much, but on the note of uncomfortable boners, what's up, everyone? I'm Joe.
Happy.
This is the SML podcast. Might as well just jump right into it. We have a guest with us. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Hugh Monahan, one of the designers on Brigador, the vehicular action isometric combat game. That sounds really boring. It's really fun. The entire world is destructible. It's basically a Kool-Aid Man simulator. I think that's the best way to summarize it. You should
Kool-Aid
buy it.
Kool-Aid Man simulator.
Terrific soundtrack.
I like how you have it, though. You can be a standard mech, or you could be anything from, like, a weird, like, almost we welded this in our garage kind of walker, or,
yes.
Hey, look, we found a badass bitch in Camaro and put a laser on top of it, which I did find out. You know, your armor ratings are serious. Do not snipe the enemy behind a gas tank when you're fucking I blew up really, really impressively.
I blew up a few times, but that's because I'm fucking terrible at using a keyboard to move around.
Oh, no, I just got too excited. I wasn't paying attention to my health. It's like, fuck yeah, oh shit, that blew up, and I was inside of it.
It's like, use WASD to move around, and then use this to stomp, and then use this to, like, turn, and then use this to... I'm like, you lost me at the WASD.
Yeah. So that's a quick sort of side note there, though, is that's one of the funniest things that we've had regarding, like, trying to convey the game to people. Because when you look at it, it just looks like a twin stick. But, I mean, so you guys have both played it now. It's way more involved than a twin stick.
Yeah.
And that's probably one of the hardest things, because it's not immediately apparent if you watch someone playing it. But as soon as you get behind the wheel, it requires a lot of concentration just to even navigate, much less, like, navigate while dodging and shooting people and also not stopping on that giant propane tank right next to
I got the first
the propane tank down. Right next to the gas station.
Yeah, I got the first two down pretty well. It's that third one I'm working on,
the blowing up. He's just good at blowing up, so
yeah,
that's been a running theme with our show. He just blows up a lot.
Yeah.
Even in Animal Crossing down. Just explosions in Animal Crossing.
No, I mean, so you guys put together basically what is it's got a decent background to it. There's three factions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fighting for control of a fictional universe, planet, country.
No, this actually happened. This is a real life
it's a
history
documentary.
That's been played out.
It's actually the U.S.
planet
of Granada.
Actually, no. I don't know if there are any Grenadans in your. I don't know if I pronounce that right, but natives in your listening audience.
Oh no, we don't have anyone in our listening audience.
Do we have any grenades in our listening audience?
Possibly. We have about 4 cats in our listening audience, and they're all staring at me right now.
No, we've made it pretty apparent in the last 170 episodes that no offense is ever meant.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So to not completely derail you or the whole thing. Yes, it's a universe that we came up with. That's kind of from a setting standpoint, it's very like Alien. So an Alien isn't like capital A, the Ridley Scott film. So the science level is sort of, it's a degree of retro sci-fi, but not to the same extent as like Fallout, which is, you know, like, whoa, what's the future like from the 1940s perspective?
Yeah.
Instead, it's more like it's the future, but without miniaturization and without advanced computing. So like very powerful computers are still large and bulky. You don't have like advanced like handheld communication devices or things like that.
Yeah, hence the fact that someone super glued a laser to the top of a Camaro.
Yeah, well, that's yeah. So our from a design standpoint, we just wanted to, we wanted everything to be like big and chunky and sort of like late 70s, early 80s era tech, but extrapolated forward. So that bears out in a lot of like the mechanical designs and things.
You know, it's almost as if we tried to make the BattleTech universe with late 80s tech and never shrink anything down.
Yeah, that's a pretty apt description for it. But yeah, so the short version of the plot of the game is that you have a megacorp in similar vein as like Weyland-Yutani. That's like our easiest cognate for describing some of this stuff. But they funded the founding of this colony. Deep,
all right, hold on. Colony. Joe, do you know who Weyland-Yutani is?
Nope.
Okay, fuck you. All right, press
I'm not the book guy on this show.
Aliens, the whole Alien series. That's the company behind everything.
Okay. Yeah.
They're sort of like the shadowy big bad.
Yes, you have.
I played Final Fantasy. I didn't watch Alien.
The two are mutually exclusive. There's still hope for you.
This is why Joe and I co-host, because I know media and Joe knows video games.
I thought you were going to go with a more pejorative term on Joe's description, but
I know media. So he's an asshole.
Anyhow, yes. So the corporation.
So founded a colony. They at some point decided to sort of nationalize everything, flip the bird to the corporation, and build giant orbital defense guns. So the plus side is that they're no longer under the thumb of this giant corporation. The downside is that they're functionally cut off because they're blockaded by the corporation. So things are kind of things kind of just went downhill after that. And so what's happening in the current, like in the events of the game, are that the company wants to get the colony back, but without doing like a major D-Day scale invasion. So what they did was seize control of the planetary network and put out a message, like the titular contract that we're actually going to have in the game, that says, hey, if you guys go around killing officers, like authority figures, destroying these orbital defense guns, and just sort of sowing discord, we'll give you more money than you know what to do with and a ticket off world.
So what are the three factions then?
You have the Spacers, the Corvids, and the Loyalists. Loyalists are the army. They are the conventional army for the planet, or for Solanobre is the city where all this stuff takes place.
That poor city.
The shit goes bad. The Corvids are a popular uprising who, like, they're sort of the next generation. So they're mostly younger, and they're dissatisfied because life in Solanobre sucks, because they're cut off from the rest of the galaxy, and like, was the corporation really that bad? But even then, like, so they're not necessarily wanting to rejoin, but they're dissatisfied with the current regime. And then the Spacers are the guys that the corporation brought on board to help mess shit up. So those guys, like, when once the batteries start going down, more spacers are able to land. So, like, they're the mercs, like, big bad mercs that come in to start wrecking shit.
And they've got, like, I liked reading the write-ups of all the vehicles. So the spacers are a little more advanced technologically then.
Yeah, they're, I mean, these are the guys, so, I mean, from the capital L lore standpoint, here's the thing, quick clarification, we love writing this stuff, we just have this specific, I mean, we don't want to, like, be burdensome for people when they're playing the game, because I love the idea of having lore and explanations for things available for people when they want it, but not making you sit through 2 hours of cutscenes.
Yeah, you don't want to shove it down their throats if they don't want it.
I loved, so Mass Effect 1, their original execution of the, like, Infopedia that they had. I'm blanking on the name for it, but...
Codex?
The Codex. That, I thought that was fabulous. We're going to end up doing something similar with our game where you can purchase intel on each of the units and, like, weapons and things. That's going to have a little, like, paragraph explanation and for both for, like, the thing itself as well as providing larger context. So most of the story of the game, or at least the context for the world in which the game takes place, is going to come through these sort of nuggets that are embedded into useful information. So, like, you buy the intel for this enemy tank, it'll tell you, okay, here's the name of the tank, here's this tank's stats, here's a little, like, history bit about the tank, and then here's a little bit about, like, the city or, like, what's going on right now that pertains to this tank in some fashion. So that's how we're sort of parceling everything out, rather than having this giant info dump where you start playing the game and you get a 15-page document of, like, this is the history of Solo Nobre.
In the 27th century,
yeah,
January 14th, the blockade. Yeah, no, and like I said, I feel like I pieced together more than enough to get a feel for, okay, not only am I going around blowing shit up, but I'm doing it for a reason, and I'm part of a faction fighting against the other two. And it felt good. So, hey, you gave enough information for me to justify murdering everyone and blowing shit up.
Like, you need a reason to murder people.
Well, but I'm saying you gave me enough of a reason to not feel uncomfortable about it.
Well, that's kind of the funny thing with a lot of games is having a degree of verisimilitude. But I mean, at least insofar as player behavior versus the context of the game, like, you the for most of the missions, and then, like, the free play mode, you are not playing a nice person. You are playing someone who's either down on their luck or just doesn't care anymore.
Even
and
it's free, like, play, it's like kill three officers and blow up everything on the map. Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds like Tuesday.
So, yeah. And the whole thing stemmed from just a degree of frustration with a lot of, and this isn't exclusive just to shooters, but just a lot of games that are combat oriented where, you know, they try and sell, like, oh, you know, this gun you're using is so powerful. And yet, you know, you fire it at, like, this cardboard shack and it stands perfectly still, you know, where the player's impact on the environment is entirely scripted or just non-existent. One of the things we were trying to do when we built this game from the ground up was we wanted an environment that properly reflected the size of ordnance that the player and enemy units are employing.
So did you guys just use a base engine, or did you pretty much
code this
from the ground up?
We wrote this from scratch, which is part of the reason why it took 5 years.
Damn.
It's one of those cases where, like, I do not recommend doing that in 95% of the cases. There are a lot of advantages to it, but it literally added 2 years of development.
Jesus.
The bright side of it is that for any of us going forward, regardless of whether we keep working together, so long as we're still doing stuff in the games industry, it was hugely beneficial to have that experience because, I mean, just the process of building your own engine just teaches you a lot about making games and, like, how just the context for a lot of this stuff. I've mentioned this before, but I think one of the best analogies is, you know, the guitarist slash singer, Jack White. He's his main shtick, I guess, for upcoming performers, particularly guitarists, is that you should, like, everyone needs to, if you want to play guitar, you have to learn how to make a guitar, because that's going to make you inherently a better guitarist if you truly understand how your instrument functions.
That's actually pretty interesting. Yeah, and I've actually seen that one of the webcomic artists I follow has actually gotten into music, and he went and built his own guitar from scratch. And he'd actually had a couple of tweets about that when he was doing it two or three years ago about how, holy shit, you know, I feel so much more connected to what I'm doing now because, holy shit, much time and work and love goes into it, you know.
I don't know if either of you guys watch the show Ink Master at all.
When the whole season's up on. Yeah,
it's basically like a tattoo competition show. The new season just started, and the first challenge that they had to do on the show was they had to sketch a woman, and then they had to put together their tattoo machines before tattooing their drawing on a pig carcass. So it was
that,
the whole...
Yeah, they did that on an earlier season, too, I know.
I don't know if they made them put them together, but this was, like, before they even got to, like, the building and met everyone. It's like, this is what you're doing immediately. And it was like, if you can't put together your own tattoo machine, why should you be a tattooer?
Yeah, no, they did that in season one or two, because I remember people were struggling. And they're like, how the fuck are you struggling with this? This is your job. Do you not clean it? Do you not take it apart? You know, how do you not know how to take care of your own stuff?
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't that had to take it apart and then it was like completely in pieces.
It's the same point, though, is that if you don't know how to take care of your own equipment, you know, how can you say that you're the best at your job?
Yeah, and two of the people couldn't even put it together in 3 hours.
That's me and IKEA furniture.
That's everyone in IKEA furniture.
Look at this desk, and I have all these parts left over.
So 5 years of development time.
Yes.
2 years of building an IKEA desk.
Yes. Yes. And not just building an IKEA. I think a better analogy would be starting to build an IKEA desk and then realizing the instructions you have are for a different kind of desk. And then, but you've already cobbled something together, so you have to, like, pivot halfway through assembling it.
It was 2 years developing the IKEA desk and then 3 years constructing it.
Yeah. And when you're done, you have a bookcase.
Yes, that's actually a very good. Yeah, because the other problem, too, was that, this was our first project, like, as a team, but also for three of the four of us, this was the first game we've ever made. Now, like, we did. That's not including these sort of like little jam projects and things over the course, you know, performed over the course of like a month or a few weeks or something, you know, like these smaller time scales. So we did build stuff together, but this was the first commercial project and also the first like properly long term collaboration. Originally it was intended though as a much shorter project, but what was happening?
It started off as a Match 3 mobile game, and now it just something fucked
almost.
Up happened. It was a fever dream.
It was a 2D pixel art brawler that took place on a single screen, like top down pixel art. You had four different classes, and it was just going to be like waves of enemy spawns. It's like kind of like a fantasy version of Geometry Wars, where like instead of just abstract ships and stuff, it was fantastic beasts, and you know the classes were like knight, mage, you know, and you know you had like a main attack ability and like a special. So
the obvious question is, how the fuck did you get from that?
From that to yeah. The short version is that. We realized that none of us actually liked the game we were making. We got into it sort of because it was a genre that was trendy at the time, and it seemed like the correct thing to do. or like a first project, but we all hated it. And so we're like, fuck this, we're going to switch to something else.
I applaud that. That's definitely fine. Applaud that.
Yeah. Well, the problem was we did that 7 times. which is how you get from medieval single screen brawler to isometric, like, dark future.
What step combat. Along the way was the J-pop dating sim?
Hey, we've actually, so a game we've been joking, but pretty, like, it's like one of the things that starts as a joke. Like, haha, wouldn't it be funny? I would totally do that. Because here's the thing, like, what we would love to do after Brigadores, you know, if we're able to keep going and keep making games, is just do this, like, quick run through a bunch of different genres, but still have it be in the Brigador, the Brigaverse. And, like, one of the things we've been joking about is we've been calling it Brigador Love Recon, where it would be like a Japanese-style dating game. But it's like you and other pilots, but then also you can date like a mech or a skeleton. Yeah, like we would just go like total off kilter with that. And it's like, I would just love to work on a game like that.
If the
and second of all,
boyfriend can succeed, then that can succeed.
Well, yeah. And it's like, but the other thing too is not anthropomorphize it at all, where it's like, no, like, with you dating like the skeleton pilot, it's like the conversation options would be like, oh, you have a very nice ossuary, like I like your bone collection, and the skeleton's like, yeah, I don't know why we're dating though, because like, you know, we can't really do anything.
are they gonna bone?
Just like having fun with it.
I mean, yeah, but you know, dating the mech, yeah, that's not. And what's funny is you can even justify that. The people who have that love of inanimate objects, like the woman who married the Eiffel Tower.
I forgot about that.
If you date the mech, I don't want the mech to be able to like talk or respond. It's just like all ... for every conversation. You're literally talking to an inanimate object.
We just finished watching RoboCop. Just take the sounds from ED-209, like the growling and the pig squealing in the ring. Yeah. Like, when, if you succeed with the sex scene, cut to black and have the weird pig squeal that ED-209 does when it falls down the stairs.
I just recently watched that scene.
This game's getting made now, isn't it? Like, we're convincing
you to make
this happen.
I hope so. No, here's the thing. You don't need to convince us. We just need, like, the time and the money to do it. And that's the point. Is like, we enjoy working together. And my brother and I are the art and design side. And with he and I, it's just like you put two of us in an empty room and we still get into trouble. And so he and I, like, we really enjoy collaborating, and that's how stuff like this comes up. And I mean, my hope is just that, you know, like, no, very few. Excuse me. I don't know if anyone goes into indie games to get rich. Like, it's a terrible idea. Or, I mean, it was a good idea like 5 or 10 years ago.
When you
now
started
it's an
the game.
Awful idea. Yeah. No. Ironically, we started 6 months before Vlambeer did, to give you context.
Oh, wow.
And they have since produced all of those games, and we're just now finishing our first one. So not making any kind of value statement there, just saying that.
So,
like,
for the people who don't know who Vlambeer is, mention all the games that they've released in the time that you're still doing this.
Yeah. So Super Crate Box, Ridiculous Fishing, Luftrausers, Nuclear Throne is their current one. There's also the Doom style one called something else. I'm blanking on it, but they've, if you look on their Wikipedia page, it's something like 7 or 8 games.
Jesus.
However, they do not have the amazing artwork that you have on your profile, which I
thank you.
From now on, when I play Brigador, that is who I imagine is piloting my
oh my
yeah,
Lord.
We got, that's, That's been my sort of goat. I realized I was talking with someone earlier, and I realized that I use different pictures for different handles and like programs and things, but they're all a picture of an angry man. Like that's just like Twitter, Skype, everything else. It's just all an angry face.
And I hope Joe finds a way to cut this face and get it onto like the YouTube or something. It's because it's such a close up. There's all sorts of things. I can imagine that that's actually you commuting to work. And if you pan back, you're riding like a moped, just angry because you know your motorcycle's in the shop right now.
You know. It does encapsulate a pretty significant portion of game development.
Just email me the picture and I'll make it the YouTube video picture.
Okay, it's like I will stare at that the whole time that I'm re-listening to the episode.
The face helps judging you rage as you listen to the episode.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah, so long story short, yeah, we'd love to keep making games and we'd like to branch out into a bunch of different stuff. Because especially after spending 5 years making a game, the last thing I want to do is start on another 5-year project. So if things go well, what we'd probably do is finish Brigador, obviously like support it post-release. But then the next project we would do, the next several projects, we'd like to be like very, very small, just to kind of scratch out some ideas, get the creative juices flowing again before we start in again on a big project.
So we won't need to wait until 2021 to play Brigadate.
No. Hope if all goes well, we should be able to get Love Recon in sometime like next year or something.
So
who knows?
That leads to a big question. You spent 5 years developing a game, and it's an awesome game, but why did you decide from whatever your previous career was, hey, you know, I want to go spend years and years and years developing indie games now?
Well, if I had known then what I know now, I don't know if I would have done it. being at towards the end of the road, I'm fairly happy if exhausted and like 25 pounds heavier. When we got this thing going, it was supposed to be like a year-long project to get us on the map, you know, but things kept changing. And also the problem of having four perfectionists on a project is that you like not like everyone has their own metrics for things that they need to refine. And there was always at least one or two of us who needed like things to be better before we could release.
So you just never had that person to say, oh my God, it's fucking fine, just move on.
Yeah, because there's this weird kind of pressure with video games where, you know, your freshman release, especially now. I mean, like this is a thing that became exacerbated over the last 5 years, but your very first release is a lot of the kind of reputation you develop as a developer. Part of it is how well you interact with the community, but part of it is like you get pretty well known for the first thing you do. And for a lot of us, a lot of it was that we really wanted to have this like spectacular debut. But also because more than anything, I think that the thing that we wanted to be known for was a really high quality product. And the problem is that the other thing we really wanted to be known for was like we all wanted to make a mechanically deep game. And you take something that's mechanically deep and also require that it be a really high quality thing, you unless you have more money than you know what to do with, and even then, not always, like it's going to take a long time. You can't do that quickly. I mean, like the old adage is that take cheap, good, and fast, and you get to pick two.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I've actually been looking at the reviews, and I mean, you guys have a 9 out of 10 right now on Steam. And
yeah, we're 93%.
That's it, you scrub.
I like someone's like, it's like Nuclear Throne in that it strips away all the bullshit and leaves you with giant robot war crimes. Giant robot war crimes are good. And then, of course, the top one is just worth at least as much as the Nickelback poster.
Which,
yeah,
of
well, yeah,
course,
I mean,
we need to cover that whole thing. Mm-hmm. Because that's how I first found out about Brigador, and that's how
everyone first found out about Brigador, apparently.
And
you got a lot of features from that.
And, like, I saw on Kotaku, it was on a number of sites, saw it on Reddit, where so many people, and we're guilty of this too, who say, oh, well, I don't think the game's worth this much. And you actually addressed those complaints, laid everything out, and explained why your game actually is worth what you're asking. Mm. Would you like to explain this whole situation?
So, you know, as with anything, just requires a lot of context. But so the whole trigger point for this was a guy posted on our forum saying rather tersely that game is worth $15, not $20. I mean, I'll be perfectly honest. Like, it was just like got me. It was like 10 o'clock at night. I was pretty crabby from working all day on something. And I was just like, are you kidding me?
I think my favorite part from that, too, was the fact that, like, a couple posts later, he's like, you still didn't change the price?
Oh, yeah. No, because here's the thing. Like, you can't the problem with, from a developer standpoint, or, like, anyone who is selling a product, anyone who has anything outward facing, when interacting with people regarding what you've produced, you have to be very careful with how you interact with them, because, you know, if people are praising you, it's easy. Then you're just like, yes, you know, shower me with your adulation.
I really appreciate it. Yeah.
But when people are negative, there's a couple different ways that it manifests. I mean, part of it is just like people shit posting, and it's like, okay, you can just
on the
that.
Internet. No.
Yeah. Like shit posting, that's a thing that's easy to deal with because it's straightforward. And then from like a management standpoint, you either ban them or, you know, that there are directed ways of dealing with that. But with people who are like snarky or who are potential customers, like people who, you know, like he was clearly interested in the game, but just what from his perception, what was being presented versus his value judgment for it, like those weren't in line, which is why he was posting. Now, admittedly, it's sort of a rude way of articulating
yeah.
it, but,
yeah.
but the it stems from like the impulse is I'm interested in this thing, but you are charging more for it than I think it is worth. Why do you do this?
Yeah.
And so what's hard is like you can't respond to snark with snark. Because that engenders bad blood, particularly like, you know, there's this great Silicon Valley episode where they think there's a coder who's going to try and hack them, and then in trying to it's Guilfoyle. I don't know if you guys watch the show, but Guilfoyle is one of the programmers, and he's very effete and arrogant. And so, like, they get a threat that one of his old compatriots is going to try and hack their server, and he's just like, psh, you know, I like he couldn't even do it if he tried. And so, in like this whole thing snowballs to where the guy actually, because of his snarky response, actually gets motivated to want to do that, as opposed to just being like, you know, this is just a one-off comment, you know, kind of. Go the other way, because to actually like pursue something like that takes a lot of time and effort.
Yeah.
Anyway,
when you ignore me, that's one thing. When you tell me I can't, now I'm motivated.
Yeah. Or you know, when you, it's you know, it's the whole like feeding the troll kind of thing, which I think is taken out of context a lot. But specifically, it's that being a snarky, responding snarkily when you are the person selling a product. Is like a surefire way to it's like signing up for bad things to happen.
Yeah.
because then people like that motivates people to go after you.
Yeah. Oh, this guy's an asshole. Let's just start writing shit reviews.
Exactly. And that's when you start getting your friends involved, and, you know, so that's part of it. But also it's just like, I never want to be that guy. Like there is a genuine, this isn't just motivated by like a fear of reprisal. Like there is a proactive component to this where, like, I, you know, this was the person who was interested in the game. And from my perspective, it's just like, it is, our jobs as creators to help people understand the value of what they are consuming. And so something I want to address is that a lot of people in response to that post would say, like, oh, this is just the capitalist system. You know, like this is market economy, and that there's a lot of indie games available. So, you know, we're going to pay for them what they're worth. And with everything being available, it's not worth $20. I wasn't trying to argue that, like, you should only pay $20 for this game, and that if you don't, you're a bad person. Rather, it was that, first off, the reason for setting the price as it is, from our standpoint, like, this is how we came to this conclusion of this game is worth $20. So that's why, like, I articulated, you know, the 40,000 hours of work, etc. But the other component of it is that whatever, like, the capitalist market trend is for the value of something, that valuation does not change how much work it takes to make that thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, yes, if you have a glutted market, or just for you personally, this is a thing that isn't worth $20. Maybe this is only worth $5 to you. At some point, probably you will be able to acquire it for $5. But the vast majority of money earned by developers comes from people paying full price. And you cannot, on something of this scale, now admittedly, if we were more experienced, if we didn't build our own engine, if a lot of these other things, we probably could have built it much faster and much cheaper. But starting new companies, learning these ropes, but also doing research and development, like the gameplay is fairly unique in Brigador, as well as like the complete destructibility. Like, we did a lot of things that from a design standpoint were novel. From a first game you make standpoint, were terrible ideas because it ballooned our development time.
Yeah, but I like how you track your aim with the mouse while moving with WASD and all of that.
Yeah,
stuff.
And how it's not just orientation, but also like depth.
It gives
like
you
can shoot over or under stuff.
And it gives you an ambidextrous feel to it, which is something you definitely don't get from a lot of games of that style.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, the point being that I just wanted to articulate that, like, we charged $20 because this took a really long time and a lot of really hard work to make. And this is also, like, if anything, a gross undervaluation for the work that went into producing something like this. And if outside of outliers, like, it's one thing if you're Jonathan Blow or Flambier or like someone where you're product is selling in the hundreds of thousands. In that case, you can still do well charging only $5 or $10.
Yeah.
And especially when you have an established audience that you can rely on, that gives you a lot more flexibility in these kinds of things. But for the most part, like assuming a sort of standard market response, if you can't charge at least $20 for something like this, you can't afford to make that thing. And it ends up turning into a losing equation. And what's going to happen is that if you can't charge $20 for products of this scale, developers are just going to stop making them. Like for me, advising someone right now going into making a game, like, I, as much as I love mechanically deep games and these big complex projects, I would say you're crazy. Like, you cannot, if your objective is to create a financially stable company, don't work on anything that takes more than a year to produce and shoot for a $10 to $15 price point. because otherwise you'll get pinned to the wall.
That's a poster. That's some sage advice, and you know, because a lot, thanks to Steam, it's really easy to make and submit an indie game and get it through. And I know there are complaints that some games should never have been approved through Greenlight or whatnot, but you guys have a polished, really fun game, but you're also competing with the huge numbers of polished, fun games that come out almost
thousands of games showing up almost weekly on this service.
That's yeah. So if you look at a graph of releases on Steam, it's been almost exponential growth over the last 3 years.
Now, do you think that'll peter out eventually once we hit market saturation?
The companies
left standing with good ideas will just continue, and then less people are going to get in the game? Or do you think that maybe even just you'll see a lot of indie developers start to merge to make just?
I don't think that'll ever happen because part of this is. Part of this is just sort of the maturation of the form. So you saw a similar kind of thing with film, where once it became – this happened a couple times in film, the most recent one being with the advent of digital recorders.
Yeah.
Basically, like once you hit the point where the cost of producing something becomes significantly cheaper – you see a spike in the people getting involved in it. So the timing on this with games is that you've seen a huge influx of people going into it, partly because it's a genuine gold rush, right? 5 to 10 years ago, you look at all these huge successes in games, like guys who are making millions, if not tens of millions of dollars.
Braid.
I'm trying to think. Yeah, I mean, like Braid made Jonathan Blow over $5 million.
Limbo, Super Meat Boy.
Yes. It's like all those guys basically get to quit life now if they wanted to. And also you started to get larger popular penetration of games in media through things like Indie Game the Movie, through just the overall increasing clout of like nerd culture.
Yeah, Twitch now.
Twitch has been huge. But anyway, so like with this increasing preponderance of like gaming culture, a lot more people are turning to gaming as like a potentially viable thing. And it's very much sort of in vogue right now to be a games developer. So I think a lot of people are jumping into it. The problem is that you've got, A, these sort of false assumptions around how well you can do financially in indie games. Because it's like, what was true five... You know, if you're going into indie games, I think it was John Blow who said, like, if you're going into indie games now, you're 5 years too late.
Yay!
Yeah.
But now we can actually see people who are like, yeah, I've always wanted to make games, but I have a full time job and I do this on the side.
Right. I mean, that's been the benefit of it, is that you've had, through the democratization of the tools, it's you are able to make something that can be called a game with much less time and with much less skill. And that's not speaking pejoratively. I'm just saying skill as in like this sort of refined knowledge. Like you don't have to go to college in computer science in order to make a game.
Yeah.
It used to be that, like, you
can purchase an engine.
Yeah, and it doesn't even require purchasing. Like, most engines are either they're just completely free to use, like Flixel, or in cases like Unity Unreal, if you're below a certain budget level, then you don't have to pay to use it. You only pay after selling a certain number of units or a certain value level. So I think with Unreal or Unity, it's after, like, $100,000 in revenue. You like prior to that, you have like a 5% tithe to them, and after that, it increases to some other value. But the point being is that there's no upfront cost. So
it's no longer where you need to go to like the technical institute and watch commercials about learning to tighten the graphics in level 3.
No. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting situation, and I certainly think, like, I'm glad that there are way more games out there, like, because there's
funny
so much really cool stuff.
More and more people are like, yes, I would like to have no free time and potentially have my girlfriend or boyfriend stop talking to me because I'm now making a video game.
Yeah. But curious times. I think what's probably going to happen if I, like, put on my prognostication hat is that you are going to see I don't know if the rate of submissions will nosedive, but I think it's definitely going to taper off pretty hard in the next year or two. And just because, like, a lot of these efforts, just speaking as someone who is increasingly connected with, like, other developers, like, a lot of this stuff is sort of done on a wish and a prayer. And what's going to happen is that a lot of these guys, possibly us included, can't afford to do anything past the first one or two efforts into the games sphere.
Do you think people are going to take your place, or do you think they're going to be kind of discouraged when they see the last generation doing, you know, not succeeding at the level they'd hoped?
That's a good question. I don't know. Cause I think there's also a degree of, like, how transparent it is, because, you know, as a consumer, you might see, you know, you see a game or a product and you might make a qualitative assessment of, okay, this is a good product or a bad product, and whether or not you want to emulate that. But much further down that road is, like, how well did that product sell for its owners, right?
Yeah, and those aren't numbers you can just hop on, you know.
And right. Find it's even, and that's oh, go ahead.
You know, because even because you're talking about, you know, with the digital camera and everything, and I'm like, yes, I understand that because I'm a huge fan of horror and B movies, so I can attest that there was a time a couple of years ago where, holy shit, how is this on Netflix? Why is this streaming? Why is this a DVD? You know, because that,
somebody owned a GoPro.
Yeah, I can rent. No, even before that, people were like, I can go rent a digital camera for a couple $100 and film an entire movie in 7 days. And it didn't mean it was good, but it was a movie. And then they got just enough money scraped together to put together a DVD and get it on into fucking Blockbuster or onto Netflix later. And then I watched those movies.
Well, okay, so that's a really good I think that's a great point of comparison.
Yeah, some of them
have you followed through with Netflix? Like, has that changed dramatically?
It has. Netflix, for whatever reason, doesn't have up as much the B horror movies. You know, they're still coming out, but now they kind of conglomerate it. Now it's Fangoria. You know, they do their, oh, here's our 12 movies for Halloween, or, you know, little horror company. So they actually, they kind of found the best and the brightest or the newest ideas and conglomerated. They grouped together. That's why I kind of asked that question with the indie developer.
Okay, so, I understand that better, because I thought you were saying that, like, all these different indie studios are going to form one big studio,
is
preposterous.
Hey, a lot of us have the same interests. Why don't we kind of work under one production company? Which I kind of say we see that with damn it, Joe. What's the guys who did No Time to Explain?
Tiny Build.
Tiny Build feels like that kind of idea. It's a little production company that they find games and they go, "Hey, these are awesome. Let's help pimp them. Let's get them out there."
Instead, just developing, they're being more of a producer now as well, more of a publisher.
Yeah, so instead of 20 indie developers, now they're kind of going to Tiny Build, like, hey, what do you think about my idea? Is this something you can help me get off the ground and get out to people?
Yeah. Fail Better Games, the guys that did Sunless Sea, they just started one, this, like, initiative for interactive fiction. They've already funded one game that is for sale now. It's called Fund Better. So, like, they're doing it. Chucklefish, the guys that did not Terraria, but the other one, Terraria in Space. the other Terraria. Anyway, so, like, those guys practically printed money with that game. So they've published several games, which I think includes Risk of Rain. I know Risk of Rain was published by some indie studio, but you are definitely seeing that, where guys who hit it big are then using that money or using some of that money as a form of, yeah, it's like becoming their own mini publishing houses, because you have this dual bonus of like, A, they've got the money to operate that no new indies have, but also that they have these existing audiences that they can motivate to get involved.
Makes sense.
We're just like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing that's going on. So I think that definitely is, I don't know if it's entirely analogous to what went on with, like what you're talking about with the horror end of things with Netflix and stuff. But I do think there are, like, that is a relationship that's worth looking at. Like, I think there are a lot of analogies that could work between the two. And it's worth, I mean, like, for me as a developer, I think it's worth scrutinizing that and, like, researching that a little bit more, because, you know, things aren't always one-to-one ratios, but you can usually figure out some kinds of trends that can be helpful in some way, you know? So, the funny thing for me is probably one of the biggest things that's changed in the last 5 years is that I was definitely on the, like, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed spectrum of things when I first started. I mean, 'cause, like, I was the one who started the company, kind of recruited everyone. Like, really idealistic, like, oh, the first game we're going to make is going to be very intellectual. It's going to be this, you know, it's a very, very cerebral game. And then fast forward a couple years, and it's just like, all right, well, you know, probably make an action game, because that's, you know, we need something that has some kind of market appeal, but still going to be very sophisticated. And, you know, like, I have all these specific expectations and requirements. Fast forward again another 2 years, it's just like, fuck it.
Buy my game, or buy a Nickelback poster. I don't give a shit anymore.
The next game is going to have tits because they're easy to draw. Let's do this.
So how have things turned around ever since the whole Nickelback comparison?
So I'm actually writing a post on this right now that I'll be sending out to people. But long story short, we're not in the black by any means, but that post sold more copies of the game than our early access launch.
So that one dude who bitched about the price eventually led to you
earned us thousands of dollars. Yeah.
Have you heard from that guy? Did he decide to pick it up after that?
Oh yeah. No, not only did he buy it, I ended up chatting with him on Steam. We had about a half hour long conversation. And he was like, yeah, Brigger was great, you know, kind of sorry. He sort of recanted. I was like, you know, look, I wasn't trying to guilt you, but we chatted about it a while. And then I gave him a few extra copies of the game to hand out to some friends and just sort of, you know, just to let him know that there was no, you know, no bad blood there. You know, if anything, the opposite, because that was a huge windfall for us. And it was largely motivated by what he wrote. So, yeah, it's a curious thing. And it's both encouraging and discouraging, the whole scenario, just because it showed that, I mean, because, like, to be perfectly honest, our early access sales had functionally flatlined prior to that post. And, you know, and, like, once we hit main release or, like, launch new trailers and stuff, they probably would have picked back up again, but not to the same extent. But then having something like this, it was functionally like we just launched the game again. And the only other thing that we've had anything even close to that scale of impact was Giant Bomb doing a quick look. Or I guess it was an unfinished video. So when Giant Bomb did that for us back in November, we had a spike in sales. But, like, literally nothing else that we've done or, like, been involved with, you know, interview wise or anything else, nothing else has had any impact besides the response to that post and Giant Bomb coverage.
Did you ever think making a post about Nickelback would lead to the sales that it led to?
No, I don't think you can. It takes a much smarter person than me to have that level of intuition, I guess, about virality and things. Like, I got angry, I wrote it, And then I've like angrily tweeted about what I wrote. And then people are like, ah,
it just took off.
Yeah. And what happened too is I hadn't slept in 2 days when I wrote that.
Jeez.
So I finished writing it. And then, you know, I started pinging a little bit on Twitter. So like I responded to a few things and then passed out. And then by the time I woke up, there was a Kotaku article. And the other thing that's funny about that to me is that that's actually, so Kotaku has covered us before, but it was as part of this like multi-state, like they'll have like an indie, like here's what's up on indie, and they'll talk about like 4 or 5 different games. So they did that for us once, as part of this like conglomeration thing, and it didn't impact us at all. So the first time they've ever actually done like a full coverage, and like we've approached them several times. The first time they actually covered us was my like angry shit post, which I find infinitely entertaining.
Hey, it gets the hits. It gets hits.
Yeah. So anyway, so like what I was saying earlier, how it's both encouraging and discouraging is just that the fact that we got the conversion rate that we did as a result of that post. So like our the metric from views to purchases, we were about 2%. So yeah, 2% of people who clicked the link and visited our Steam page ended up buying the game, which is much higher than the average conversion rate. Wow. So, I mean, what that showed to us was that visibility is more of an issue than anything. Like we have the quality product, like people seem to like it. It's not complete rubbish. So it's now the issue at hand is just visibility. It's just getting people to know about it. And so like obviously we're trying to finish the game. Like that's the most important thing. But just below that is doing everything we can to just get the name out there, just to get people to know that it exists. Because like almost all of the posts of people mentioning us, or like we were even on one of Rooster Teeth's subsidiaries. Like it's called the No. They did a video where they were talking about Jane from Firewatch, her post that was like 2 weeks before mine, talking about like people buying. They had a poster on their Steam forum where the guy bought the game, played through it, and finished it. And it was beneath the 2 hour mark. So he was talking aloud. He was like kind of thinking aloud whether he should return it or not.
Yeah, I saw that.
And she wrote this
post
long
too.
Response. Yeah. So anyway, so on this Rooster Teeth video, They opened by talking about that, and they're like, yeah. And then this developer from Stellar Jockeys on a game called Prigador, like, which we've never heard of, said this. And I'm just like, like, at least they've heard of it now. But yeah, it's just like very ambivalent feelings about that, because
that's almost kind of a dick move too, to be like, oh, we've never heard of. It's like, come on, man.
Well, I mean, it wasn't like. The way I came across was just genuine, like, this is a thing that went viral from a game that we've literally never heard of. Like,
yeah,
it was genuine,
yeah, no,
like...
I understand they were going for the comedy and the honesty, but I was like, yeah, but does that help?
there's definitely a degree of, like, despondency involved there, where it's just like, you know, we've been screaming about this thing for, like, 2 years. Our first trailer for the game launched February 2014.
Wow. So literally 2 years.
Yeah. And the
funny
thing about that,
I guess.
Yeah. Thanks. It turns out we're going to end up releasing the final release for the game is going to be almost to the day 5 years after I started the company.
Wow.
But anyway, it's just a curious thing. Cause like there's,
And I always pull this game out of my ass for comparisons, but it's so easy to use. You know, here's your game, a fully polished game in a late early access phase. It's a lot of fun, and it's a very gorgeous game. And you're struggling to get people to notice it, but you know, again, Who's Your Daddy was the only fucking thing being played on all the YouTube channels that I followed for like 3 weeks. And that's an early access alpha game that's creepy as fuck in terms of how polished it is, you know. So it literally is like, what do people grab on, and how do you, as an artist and as a developer, find the timing to get everybody? Hey, check this one out. Stream this one, you know.
It's, I mean, the answer to that is like, if luck. We knew the answer to that, we would be doing much better.
I'm just starting to wonder if Pappy's getting kickbacks from the Who's Your Daddy guys for how fucking often he mentions it on this show.
It's just such an easy goddamn thing to compare, because again, it's a fun game, but it looks like shit because it's pre-alpha early access.
I think you're getting paid off to keep mentioning it on the show.
But people love it. That's but again,
well, that's here's the thing. The reason why most conspiracy theories are false is the whole, you know, Occam's razor. It's the simplest explanation is true. Yeah. And the reason why, here's the thing. Games like Who's Your Daddy make me die a little bit on the inside, but I also don't like the good for them. Like I'm glad you guys are getting, like, it's a tremendous windfall and it's awesome that you're getting that kind of coverage. It's frustrating when, you know,
yeah,
I don't know about that road. Yeah, but it's just the point there is just the reality of especially Twitch is funny, and like talking points sells much better than just like cool niche. And even then, like, I don't want to like oversell what
to do. Brigador, though, I almost want to show that to all my old friends from high school who just played the shit out of MechWarrior, because I'm like, I never got into that because you had to hotkey your whole keyboard twice. You know? But it's like, dude, this game is more fun, easier to pick up, but just as destructive, you know. And there's a lot of, like you said, like you advertise in the game, you can play it any style you want. Do you want to do fast and light? Do you want to do heavy? Do you want to go in between? Do you want to be a walker or a tank or, again, a Corvette with a laser strapped to the top? You know? And it changes the style of play depending on what vehicle you're running around with.
We don't have them playable right now, but there are playable power suits as well. So,
oh, God.
Tiny little guy.
Oh, hell yeah.
So that's basically, so we don't have difficulty settings in the game.
It's
we have like strength level progressions, but yeah, but the way we handle it is through your choice of vehicle. Yeah. And what we're planning on doing for the story campaign is that the difficulty is just going to be based. It's going to be like Rogue Squadron, where you can pick like X-Wing, Y-Wing, or A-Wing, where that's going to be how we're going to have two or three different builds you can pick from for each mission. And the first option is going to be like the ideal vehicle and kit
to win that mission.
Yeah. And then here's like cool alternate way of doing it. And then option three is like, fuck you.
Like
for the people who really want to do that.
Yeah. Destroy everything on the map. Here's your power suit.
Yeah. Have fun.
The fuck you option's always the good one.
This is the thing that's nuts. I mean, admittedly, we've been in early access since October. But I mean, we've got guys who are like knocking on the door of 100 hours of playtime.
Wow.
Hey. See, I really appreciate, though, that since you haven't put the story mode in, I can confidently say that I beat your story mode, and that's great because I did both the tutorial and the advanced tutorial. So yours is the first Steam game where I beat the whole story mode.
Congratulations, Pappy. Something to strive for in life.
Make sure to give you the platinum PS4 medal.
Speaking of, are there any plans to eventually, when the final game is done, to bring it over to consoles?
Give you is that we want to, and there is possibility space there, but I can't give a solid answer yet.
You kind of want to hit the popularity level before you consider that, right?
Well, what it comes down to is how well Brigador sells, because the thing is, functionally speaking, porting to a different platform, I mean, you're talking months of work just from an engine standpoint. And then on top of that, design, like the reason why we don't have full controller support right now is that for the fineness of what you need to do in the game, we've already spent a lot of time trying to get a controller to work, and we have a solution that we think works. It's like 80%, and the question is whether because we don't want to put up an option until we're like fully comfortable endorsing it as like an alternate control scheme, and two, like we don't want to put up a control scheme that's like actively hampering a player's ability to play the game. So, I mean, but at the same time, you know, it's like if you play like CS:GO on PC, there's an option to play with a controller. Now, you would be insane to try and play that in any kind of competitive environment with a controller, but there's a lot of people who still just play CS:GO against bots, and for which, you know, you can set a different difficulty mode, and like for which it's perfectly fine to play that with a controller.
So what it's saying, Joe, like, is Joe, get good. All right.
Yes.
I need my controller.
We want to do it, but basically Brigador needs to sell well enough to show that it's worth the risk and money involved in porting it, because it's going to be a lot of work, and it's also like it means that after Brigador is done, we're going to spend the next year porting it instead of working on another game.
I do have one request though, is if you do a dating sim, please have your avatar as one of the people I can choose from.
That super angry guy.
Yeah, because we will go out on a date. We will have spaghetti. We will then walk home, and I will kiss you, and it will be wonderful.
You're going to touch my wiener. Or else.
We definitely... Very rarely do we not tangent very much, but I think it's been such a fun talk so far. We've just been talking about the game.
We haven't tangented it yet.
Tangented it too much. But I do want to have my favorite question is, when over the last 512 years while you were working on this game, what other games did you like to play to kind of chill out, relax, or even just kind of get ideas? Or even just what are you playing?
I have to think back because it's been 5 years.
I think you played Fallout New Vegas, Fallout 3, and Fallout 4.
I did. So I'm a huge fan of his name is J.E. Sawyer. He's a designer who was pretty seminal on Fallout New Vegas as well as Pillars of Eternity. He and like Jamie Griesmer are probably, and it's kind of funny because it's like, yeah, like as a person who's in that profession, I have my like favorites of other people in that, you know, in that shared profession. Like it's not common to talk to people in games who like people who just play games, to ask them like, who's your favorite designer? Like that's not, I mean, at most people have maybe heard of Sid Meier, and that's just because his name is bolted to most of those
everything.
Games.
Yeah.
Yeah. But to be fair, that is something I'd actually love to see more of in games. Not that we want to like completely emulate Hollywood or anything, but just that like there are extremely talented people who work in video games and who have a measurable influence on projects they're involved in. Like probably the most recognizable names are like John Carmack, Warren Spector, and Sid Meier. You know, like no offense to any other famous video game people who I'm not mentioning right now, but just
how about
like, you know,
full offense to Peter Molyneux?
Yeah, for Molyneux
because
and everyone else.
Fuck that dude.
I having spent 5 years making a game, I'm not like acquitting him, but at the same time I feel for him. Because there's a lot of pitfalls that are very easy to fall into from a development standpoint. And also, before I started making games, I talked so much shit. And 5 years later, I'm just like, oh, what? It's like a bad hangover looking back. And like, what did you do? What did you do? Anyway, to actually answer your question, and not to tangent off of that again, right now, so I just recently got an upgrade in hardware, so I can finally actually play stuff now. But I'm currently working my way through XCOM 2.
That's been a popular one with people on our show lately. Yeah. So much good about like, that.
To show my nerd cred on this one, like this is after doing a good like 70 hours in Xenonauts, which came after replaying the original XCOM and Terror from the Deep again in anticipation of Xenonauts' release, then going on to XCOM 2. Some of my close friends,
and that's why the game took 5 years to come out.
Well, that too. That too. Although, I mean, one of the frustrating things is just like I haven't, especially compared to my gaming habits prior to starting Stellar Jockeys. My like Steam hours logged are pretty pitiful these days. It's been a lot more in the last 2 weeks, just because I've been like really burned out, and you need some break time. Yeah, I've been playing a lot of XCOM 2. I just recently got back into Battlefield 4, which it's like I'm only playing Battlefield 4 because it's like I can't get anyone to play Bad Company 2 anymore. So Battlefield 4 is the closest we can get to that now. Bad Company 2, I think, is one of the greatest shooters ever made.
Funny story is Bad Company 2 is the first game I ever returned to the store.
Really?
I was just so bad at it, like, because unfortunately, I've been introduced to modern first-person shooters with Call of Duty, and Call of Duty really is the easy mode of shooters. You know, at point, you know, short of auto aim, it's so easy. Bad Company 2, it's like, oh, where am I aiming? Oh, you see that tiny little dot right in front of you? Yeah, that's yeah, a suggestion of what you're. that there was no reticule at all, and that, you know, it just. I started playing. I'm like, I am just so offensively terrible at this game. I'm just going to return it, you know, honestly, mm-hmm. rather than spend 100 hours it would take me to un-Call of Duty myself.
That's really funny. Yeah, Bad Company 2 was, I mean, it helped a huge amount that I had like six guys who were all like between all of us, there was always like a full squad on the game. And sometimes we could fill like two squads. And then you've got everyone on voice chat together, and when it comes to multiplayer, I'm the guy who doesn't shut up. I might not be the best like at actual like pointing and shooting at people and killing them, but half of my enjoyment in playing multiplayer is in coordinating people. So, like, my two favorite games, multiplayer, have been Gears of War and Bad Company 2.
We got to get you on our squad for Fortified. Holy shit. have you checked out Fortified yet?
The only reason why I haven't gotten into, like, the full Grognard games, like Arma 3 or Fortified or stuff, is just because, like, I only want to go down that rabbit hole if I can go all the way down.
Yeah, well, Joe, in my defense, I've tried to team talk us, and you just say, fuck you, I'm making my wall of death. And that's it.
No, you try coming over to an area that I have taken care of.
I'm always talking. I'm saying, something's coming up left. Anyone got that? Something's coming up right. Hey, I got this. Hey, there's two things going that way. And then Shiz is talking to his viewers on Twitch, and you're just like, I'm over here blowing things up.
I'm handling my shit. Yeah.
Yes, but again, I don't know unless... See, here you go. Hugh, I'm sure you can agree.
Yep, yep.
And Shiz is just running off everywhere else.
Nobody knows handling his shit if he never replies. So
I reply.
I'm like, hey, yeah, like, it's just, after I'm already on your side, like, no, dude, I got it. Like, well, if you'd said that, I wouldn't run over
here. Don't forget, 90% of the time that we're playing a game with Shiz, he's talking to his viewers. So we can't get a word in edgewise.
I think I've got a pretty good picture of what's going down here.
Yeah, you need to check out Fortified. That game is fucking awesome.
It's one of those that's like it's been on the radar. I just haven't. Like XCOM 2 was the first game that I bought, you know.
With Fortify, though, if you end up with a team of three other people to play with you, expect to waste a day or two just playing the game.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll definitely.
So if you have an Xbox One and you pick up Fortified, hit us up and we will play Fortified.
I'm going to make a note of that right now.
It's basically anyway. Four player tower defense third person shooter.
Here we are. We're selling you another game after we're done.
Yeah. I mean, but that's is that like in a similar ballpark as Sanctum?
I don't know what Sanctum is.
Yeah, I'm
it's the guys that end up making Goat Simulator.
Oh God.
They're early on. They made Sanctum and Sanctum 2, which
similar, but yeah, I'm watching the video right now. It's similar, but it's smaller and third person.
Okay. Yeah, no, I'll definitely check
it
out.
It's the retro 50s sci-fi style. Like you're a spaceman or a secret agent, you know, that kind of. So, the Rocketeer. Yeah.
The Rocketeer.
Yeah, no, actually, Sanctum, similar in, you know, obviously the style is totally different, but yeah, in that here's your area, defend it and shit's
going to happen. Yeah, the idea of doing like a tower defense, but where you are like an actor in that area. So it's, you know, similar ballpark as like Dungeon Defenders.
It's a lot in the Dungeon Defenders realm.
You wanted like what I was playing back when. That was so like 2011, 2012. Like we played a lot of Dungeon Defenders, a lot of Bad Company 2. And I'm trying to think of what else. I did manage to rally all of my friends once for a game of Artemis.
One
time. I ended up as captain. There was alcohol involved. And somewhere over the course of the next 5 hours, everyone refuses to ever play that game with me ever again.
Nice.
So it must have been really good.
I know you talk about the TeamSpeak thing, and again, I've said this before on the show, and Joe will attest, but yeah, the most fun I ever had playing an FPS was when I hopped on back when, you know, it was still kind of random everyone chats thing, but I got on a team, I want to say it was Modern Warfare 2, but they were all ex-Marines.
And,
I'm Air Force, so I'm quote unquote military, but I don't know how to fucking run a squad. So these guys are just like, what you got? What's your weapons? All right, we're gonna call you. You know, we're gonna throw you in Charlie when we. And they were just fucking done, and we just wiped the floor with everybody because they're doing call signs and this and that. And I'm just like, fuck that, man. You just point, and I will go.
it's just really fun to like that's. And that to me, I mean, as far as like super long term goals, something I would love to be involved in making have these sort of large scale cooperative. It doesn't have to be PvP. It could be PvE. This idea of first off of a skill based interaction. So it's akin to something like an FPS where it's not a stat grind. It's like the largest consideration for success is your ability to play the game and people. That's the kind of stuff that I'm really interested in. And that's kind of also my frustration with a lot of MMOs. Like the idea of an MMO, like MMOs on paper, I love it. But in execution, and I realize that this is heavily bounded by just the realities of developing these kinds of large scale interactable games. In execution, I have very little interest in the game, in the actual like game that ends up being produced. I should probably give a more serious consideration to PlanetSide 2, but the few times I have kind of gone down that road, I was just like never happy with how it ended up. So I don't know.
Back in the early days of our show, our two co-hosts back then, They were big in a planet side, and they would talk about it all the time. And since it was only PC back then, I only got to like hear about how cool it was because it was supposed to be a launch title for the PS4, but then it got delayed for 2 years.
Yeah.
So when it finally came out and I finally got to download it and try it out, I started up a game, zero instruction. I had no idea what was going on. I teleported to the first area, the game crashed, and I haven't turned it back on since. If it crashed in the first 5 minutes, fuck that. I mean, it's just zero direction, zero anything. I had no idea what the hell was going on, and then it just crashed. That's not a good first impression. So
that's unfortunate.
Gave it a second look. Then again, it doesn't help that it's on the PS4, because not a big fan of that thing.
Despite having both PS4 and Xbox One, I've hardly done anything with them, which is kind of disappointing. It's like I stare longingly at it on my TV stand. That's the extent of my interaction with consoles right now.
Like, yeah, I bought you. Yeah.
I think like my PS4 isn't even in my apartment for the last year.
Oh god,
it's been at my friend's, because what I realized, like, I got it because back when we were looking into PS4. For porting and stuff, I was like, okay, well, before I talk to Sony, I need to be acquainted with their platform, you know. So I got a PS4, played some Destiny, and then got really angry. Anyway, so I got through it, but then she's like, I literally stopped playing games for a couple months, and so like it was just collecting dust on my bookshelf. And by this time, like, my buddy is having an aneurysm because Bloodborne had come out. That's probably. So, like, with my current circle of friends, just playing through Dark Souls 1, 2, Bloodborne, like, those, the Souls games has been, like, probably the most consistent, like, staple.
We figured out how to get to Dark Souls eventually.
Yeah.
That's...
So he was having an aneurysm because, like, he doesn't have a PS4. And here's one sitting in my room, and Bloodborne is out. And so I would just see him, and it's like a guy who's, like, you know... has to, like, you know, you've got like the giant something on your teeth, but he can't say anything, but just like wants to, you know. And then finally I was like, oh, so do you want to like borrow my PS4 or something, because like I'm not really using it. And he was trying so hard to be like, oh, you know, like,
and he came right there, just buckets of cum. Oh my god, you finally asked.
I think you have a different interaction with the Souls games than most people do.
Joe likes to wank.
Don't
we all? I'm married. I need something.
Like, why does it actually sound like someone's wanking right now?
Oh, sorry. I have a pen. Sorry. I'm fidgeting. Anyway.
So, yeah. Let's never talk about that again.
On that note...
Yeah, I honestly hope that Brigador eventually makes its way to consoles. I think it would be cool if you looked into the Xbox One game preview program, which is kind of like Steam Early Access. It might be cool to see it show up on there, gauge some interest, and they've had like 4 or 5 games already on the game preview program, and right now Ark is a big one. I think Prison Architect just showed up on there, which I tried to inquire with.
So is it like a playable thing in progress?
Yes.
Or...
It's basically early access.
Okay. Yeah. I'll definitely look at it. So the long story short is we have dev kits. We're like set up to do it. It's just a matter of,
turning them on.
Seeing how things go. So,
cross my fingers.
Yeah, we'd love to, but we'll see what the future holds.
Well, just keep name dropping Nickelback, and shit's gonna sell like crazy.
who knows? They might fund us.
Are you going to like inquire about licensing a Nickelback song for the end credits?
No, we're actually very fortunate in that we have a tremendous soundtrack already, so we have no need for outside music. As humbled as I would be to have Nickelback's patronage.
Do you have a newfound respect for Chad Kroeger and his band of merry men?
I mean, it's a thing.
The answer is no. The answer is still no. Fuck them.
Okay. Yeah, so short side note is I actually had a lot of people come up to me and were like, man, what do you have against Nickelback? I was just making a funny. Like, I wasn't.
They're terrible. That's what I have against them. They're fucking terrible.
Well, that's a funny thing too. Is like I haven't listened to enough Nickelback to actually have a serious opinion about them. So it's just like I don't think about Nickelback. Nickelback is not a thing that is a regular part of my life. Like, so
now it is. You've yeah. now made it.
Better
a part
they know,
of your
they know how
lore.
To make, they know how to make catchy music that I don't like. I mean, that's just, you know, fine.
Hey,
you know.
Mazel tov.
They're Canadian, so that's all you need to know.
They made money, and that's fine.
And Chad Kroeger sucked his own dick for a case of beer.
Shit, I would do it just because I could, so you know, I can't really judge him on that. Like, I wouldn't even be on your show right now, Joe, I'll be honest. Hey, can you be on the show tonight? No, I will be sucking my own dick.
Well, at least it'd be your own for once.
But yeah, so anyhow.
So speaking of the soundtrack, is it available to download anywhere?
You can stream it right now. If you just Google search Brigador OST, Matt Pusty / Makeup and Vanity Set. He has several tracks available for streaming right now. We are working on finalizing. We're like, there's just a couple tracks left that need the final pass plus like mastering the whole thing. And then what we're going to do is we're going to add it. It's like the premium edition of Brigador. It's like the vanilla game's $20. And then the premium edition is going to have the soundtrack plus a bunch of other goodies that we're currently working on. That like for people who already own the game, you can just buy the add-on. But it'll also just be available for purchase from people who already, or for people who like first looking to buy in the first place. But yeah, I mean, it's almost 2 hours of music.
Wow.
So like we've got, and it's all original, all just for the game. And
that's awesome.
We're currently looking into the possibility of doing a vinyl press as well.
Ooh.
We wouldn't be able to do it for the full thing because that would require four discs or records, sorry.
There you go, Pappy, add to the vinyl collection.
But we would absolutely love to do that. I mean,
I'm not sure if you're able to, but at the end of our show every week we usually play some music, and if you have any tracks that you're able to share with us, I'd love to play some music from Brigador at the end of the show.
Sure thing. Yeah, I can. I'll Skype you the link right after this, so that you can just pull one of those tracks.
Cool.
We're super excited about it. And in fact, the funny thing is, I think a lot of people are more excited about the soundtrack than they are about the game, which I have sort of ambivalent feelings about. But I'll take it. It's been a really awesome collaboration. So we're happy to see, happy that people have responded really well to it.
I'm glad things are starting to look good for the game, and I know we're going on an hour and a half now, surprisingly. We usually do about an hour for interviews, but you've just been so goddamn fun to talk with.
I'm just a dream.
I've legit had a blast talking with you. And
it's that English teacher vocabulary that's been keeping
us. Just dropping the big words on the show. Like, half our listeners are going to be fucked. They're going to need to, like, load up dictionary.com for half this show.
Yes.
It took me 4 hours to listen to it because I had to go to a thesaurus.
What's Verrecchius mean?
Okay, I'm sending you the link to music stuff. I got to get to it. This is the second conversation that went two times as long as I thought it would that I've had today. So
I wonder if there's a common thread there.
Shh.
Hey, I really appreciate you spending this extra time with us, man. It's been fantastic.
It has been a wonderful conversation. You are welcome back anytime, because we didn't have our usual off-topic shenanigans with you. We actually stayed on topic for the most part. And
yeah, we'll have to have you back sometime so you can tell tales of the war in school.
I'm always down for shenanigans, especially getting pistol whipped in the face.
You can't just drop that you got pistol whipped in the face.
No, sorry. I haven't actually been pistol whipped in the face. I was just referring to Super Troopers. I saw for the first time a year ago. I just missed the Super Troopers train in college.
Super Troopers 2. So I'm looking forward to that. No, that is the only movie that, because whenever I go home to visit, I bring a film for my parents, and that's the only movie, Super Troopers, that my parents didn't like. 45 minutes into it, my father turns to me and says, "Does this ever get funny?" And I just went, "Okay, well, I'll just eject the disc and we'll watch something else." You know, at that point, I know, because
eject a disc, sweeping silently.
I used to like your dad.
But I mean, I've shown him so many things that, you know, that he always enjoyed. So I'm like, okay, one miss, I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah. That's a huge miss, though.
It's a particular type of humor that I think is also very generational.
It's very dry, sarcastic. I thought he'd like it because he introduced me to Monty Python, but it turns out they weren't similar enough. Yeah, it is what it is. If one thing. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Cannot go down that road again. maybe next time. But thanks a lot for having me, guys, and have a lovely night.
You too. Thanks again for joining us, and hopefully we'll get you back on again sometime soon.
Sure thing.
Have a good one.
Take care.
Man, that was a good chat.
That was great. Now I really don't want to just talk to you. Can we just end it?
No, we have shit to do.
All right. So tell you what, tag, you're it. I'm going to go pee. You can start talking about the first game.
All right. I will cover the two iOS games I previously talked about. I Love My Circle, by developed by Joshua Barr. It released March 1st on iOS and Android for $2. There's another game named Zirkle, developed by Marc Andre, I'm going to butcher this, but I'm going to try, Wibison. I released a while ago on iOS. I don't have a date for it, but that one's also $1.99. I talked about I Love My Circle, but I also got friend of the show, Jacob Garner, a.k.a. Sweatpants, for those of you who remember. He covered both of them for us as well, and here are his thoughts as transcribed to me over Facebook. He said he didn't love I Love My Circle as much as me, but I still thought it was a fun diversion for a minute or two. The controls are obviously easy to master, but the random shapes can be difficult, if not impossible at times. Usually it starts off with simple shapes to dodge, but I've had games where it starts with a hulking black rectangle coming at me, and there's no way to dodge it, so my game is over as soon as it began. Which, obviously, he sucks, because when the big one comes at you, you just hug the side of it, or you go out and around it, because you can go out of the circle for a couple of seconds. Luckily, there's no real load time or ads between games, so bouncing back is easy. It's simple to get frustrated and quit, only to find yourself back at it an hour or so later. It'd be interesting in seeing how a game like this might be with a controller, but the iPhone controls are fine. I felt like $2 is a little steep, but as Joe pointed out, no ads or freemium shit, so that's a plus. I Love My Circle is a good diversion when you need something to occupy your time for a couple of minutes, and definitely keeps you on your toes with its challenges. On the other hand,
are you still talking?
Blow me. On the other hand, I'm a big fan of Zirkle. In this game, you have to get the flames to touch each other as they spin around a group of circles. If you remember playing Spin Doctor on your Mac back in 94, holy crap, I suddenly feel old. It's got that kind of feel, mixed with the relaxed nature of Switchball on the Xbox 360. I really dug it, as it was easy to figure out the mechanics of the game, plenty of challenges, and the music really fits the game. Playing the game for 30 minutes at a time was easy to do, as I found myself lost in the game. I definitely recommend picking this game up. Not only is a fun game to play, but I could see it as something that relaxes me in a high-stress area, like waiting for an airplane or something, or in a place where you need to amuse yourself for a good amount of time. So both of us think Zirkle's pretty good. I think I Love My Circle is better than Jacob thought, but he's a dipshit, so I don't trust him anyway.
I'm not really sure he wrote that last sentence.
I swear he wrote it there. Next two games I could cover are both published by 8th Floor. We talked with them briefly in the past with Alien Shooter and Royal Defense. They just had two new games come out on the Vita this week. The first is Royal Defense Invisible Thread, again developed and published by 8th Floor, released March 1st on the Vita for $5.99. It is on sale with PlayStation Plus for $5.39 right now, so big,
that's a weird
big
number.
Bucks off. Hey, 60 cents off, 10%. If you heard our review for Royal Defense, copy and paste that exact review, because it basically picks up exactly where Royal Defense left off. Royal Defense Invisible Thread is more of what you enjoyed in Royal Defense. If you have not played the original Royal Defense, do not start with Invisible Thread, because there's no tutorial, no introduction, no easing you in. It starts off full blast, ready to kick your ass, because it automatically assumes that you've played the first game. To kind of make it a little easier, it starts you off with 150 gems that you could use to upgrade your shit. It is not something that you can just pick up and get into easily. Like, there, even this game's called Invisible Threat because number of the enemies in this game are invisible, and the only way to hit them with your turrets is to hit them some other way. Like, the spells that you would get gradually through the first game, they're all unlocked at the beginning of this one. So
it literally is like a continuation.
Yeah, pretty much. It feels like they ended the game and they're like, you know what? Let's just keep going, and then we'll just make another half to sell.
I kind of like that, though, because, you know, with most sequels, you start over. They find a way to, like, reduce your powers and abilities.
Yeah.
And this one's like, nope. This is where you left off.
This, pretty much. There is apparently, there's mines in the game that can mine money and earn you money, that you can upgrade them and give them different abilities. Apparently, you can upgrade it to have a satellite dish, so it can make those invisible enemies visible. And I didn't know, because it didn't tell me anything. I had no idea how to do it until I went online and Googled, because it is an older game that was released on, I believe, Steam, PC somehow, that people have played it on PC, and they're even online, people are like, how the fuck do you hit these invisible things? Like, I don't understand. It doesn't, like, there's no explanation to the invisible enemies. I started the game, and it's like, here's a new enemy. That doesn't, like, am I supposed to lose this first stage? Is it like one of those, oh, you lose the first one, and then it kind of eases you in? No, it's here's the game, play. Oh, you didn't play the first one? You're stupid, you should play the first one. So if you played and enjoyed the first Royal Defense game on the Vita, this is a buy it, because it's fucking awesome. It's good. If you have not played the first game, this is a 100% deny it, with the advice to buy the first one. It is absolutely split down the middle, because either you've played it before or you haven't. And if you haven't, this is not the one to start with, because it's like starting a game halfway through.
Yeah, that's definitely a little weird. It's an interesting decision from the developers, too, to be like, hey, we really want to make a sequel. But rather than make a sequel, we're just going to make a part two.
Part of me even wonders if maybe it was all part of a larger game, but they kind of, like, instead of selling the one game for $15, they just cut it in half and sold it for $6 each. Which I can see that being a thing.
Yeah. So, what other games here?
The other game from 8 Floor is called Pirate Solitaire, developed by 4-Hit Limited, published by 8 Floor, also released March 1st on the Vita, and this one is $4.99. It's not so much solitaire as it is Mahjong with poker cards. You'll have a deck of cards that you can draw, and it shows two at a time, and then there is a layout kind of solitaire style in the middle of the screen with a handful of cards shown and the rest are flipped over. Kind of like Spider Solitaire, or yeah, is it Spider? No, Pyramids or Tri-Peaks, where you might have to like go in numerical order or you have to match two to equal a total number. This one is Mahjong style where you have to match pairs. And you tap the two cards, they disappear, and whatever's underneath them gets revealed. And you have to go until you reveal however many X number of special cards there are on the stage. You can earn in-game money by playing to get Joker cards that you can tap on it, and it changes to just a Joker, and you can use that to get rid of anything else. You can use reshuffles where it takes all the cards from the field and from the deck that are still available and shuffles them back out. So if you're stuck, it could help you there. Or you can purchase undoes, like just take back the last move you did. You can buy in-game money with real money. I haven't had a need to yet, but it's an option, I guess, if you need it. I haven't had a need for it. I don't see why anyone would. I wanted to put a lot more time into Royal Defense, but I spent all my time playing Pirate Solitaire because it was stupidly addictive. For $5, this one is an easy buy. It, especially, it's awesome, fun, brainless, just Mahjong style game. And I'm a fan of Mahjong games, so for me, yeah, it's an easy buy, especially for only $5.
Awesome, fun, brainless, just like the show.
8 Floor, they're not releasing like super high quality action adventure, like $60 games, but they're putting out good, quick, easy, fun games for cheap on the Vita, which that's all I need in life, is just some fun entertainment to keep me busy in between stuff like Far Cry or The Division or whatever else. It's all about having those tiny diversions in between other stuff. So yeah, 8 Floor knocks it out of the park. Two more awesome games from them. Buy Pirate Solitaire and buy Royal Defense, unless you didn't play the first one, then skip it and buy the first one.
All right, so I will weigh in with my 1.25 games.
Yeah, let's start off with We Are the Dwarves. Again, developed by Whale Rock, released February 26th for $14.99, still in early access. You did talk about it last week, and I said that you need to put some more time into it because reviewing a game after only a half hour doesn't seem fair. And you put some more time into it, and you still can't really properly review the game.
15 minutes later, and I never got past that one point. Let me reiterate, 15 minutes worth of attempts, and each attempt only takes 1 to 2 minutes. I failed to get past the next set of enemies. So I am going to personally purchase this game for a coworker who enjoys the genre and is good at it. And in return, he will email us a written review of the game.
So you're still kind of like on the fence of a try it if you're into the genre.
It's really interesting. It's really fun. I just can't.
You're just too bad to properly judge it.
Yes, exactly.
So instead, we hooked you up with Californium, developed by Darjeeling and Nova Production, published by Art. Huh?
Was this the Royal Wii hooked me up, or like you and Potato decided to hook me up?
The Royal Wii.
Okay.
Me and Potato, we talked with Neko Entertainment, the guys who did Replay VHS is Not Dead. And this game, developed by Darjeeling and Nova Production, published by Neko Entertainment and Art France, it released February 17th on Steam for $9.99. Tell us about this game.
All right, well, here's actually the thing that will immediately tell people if it's going to be in their wheelhouse or not. What did this release in conjunction with?
A documentary on Philip K. Dick.
Yes. So for those of you listening who know who Philip K. Dick is, and if you go, huh, did they release the game based on the writing style and ideas of Philip K. Dick? The answer would be yes. And now if you actually know who Philip K. Dick is, or if you don't, and you happen to know what a movie is, he's one of the most adapted sci-fi writers of all time, including Total Recall, Shoobadoobadoop-doop.
Good answer.
No, sorry. I actually am trying to like not cough all over the microphone at the same time. Total Recall, fucking brain farting, shitting out all over the things that I just brain farted. Jesus Christ. A Scanner Darkly.
Scooby-Dooby-Doop-Doop.
Scooby-Dooby-Doop-Doop. Minority Report, Paychecked, The Adjustment Bureau, and Blade Runner are all based on short stories from Philip K. Dick. I just had to cheat and pull up Wikipedia while I stumbled. Sci-fi dystopian, the man also unfortunately had a lot of mental issues towards the end of his life. So the game is, hey, you are an alcoholic, drug-addicted, failed writer whose wife just left him. Hooray! Welcome to a video game.
Yay!
You cannot interact with the world at all. Here's the key part. You listen to messages. If you get close to a person, they begin a set of dialogue to talk to you. And otherwise, you find a TV that's making noise and you stand close to it and a disembodied voice tells you about how shitty your life is. And then a number comes up on the TV in Roman numerals. That is the number of things that you can activate in your vicinity that will open up portals to another universe. So you find all. Yeah, so you find, and here's the game element. Some of the things, it's always the same symbol. But some things are glitching, and you know, okay, it's glitching. When I get close enough to it, the symbol appears. Other times, the symbol only appears if you're not looking at it. So you have to rely on, like, the bright light shining over your shoulders, and then you turn around, and you now have 2 seconds to click the symbol before it disappears again. Other things, you know, are just simple glitched, or the hardest ones are the ones that are – they only activate the symbol when you're at a very specific location. So you kind of have to do a lot of walking and looking at the same time. Once you've unlocked enough, the narrator talks. It kind of gives you little hints and clues about your life or just talks about how shitty your life is. And once you finish the scene, as it were, you are transported to another dimension. So the second dimension, you are a glorious writer of the nation of California, and everyone looks up to you. And instead of your wife leaving you, your wife was arrested for treason. And then the third, which is where I left off, I got to the third world, and now I'm a Martian explorer. So supposedly there's 4 parts, and that's all it is you explore the world. But you can't interact. You can't open doors, lift anything, look at – you know, you can't fiddle with anything. You can only get close to people who will talk to you and touch the symbols when you've activated an area. But it's really interesting. And, you know, I can't call it the relaxporation that we talked about with Submerged, but because it does get frustrating when you're, oh, hey, look, the TV says one more item. Where? I did have to give up. I did have to twice go to a walkthrough, and both times I was like, oh, I'm really glad I did that because that thing was, I was convinced, the one thing I was convinced wasn't. Like, no, there's no way this can trigger. It's too close, da 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 da. But fortunately, someone put a YouTube walkthrough of the whole game without commentary. So if you're really curious about the game, you can check out part one of that, and it'll give you an idea if you're going to like it or not. And I say it's – if you're a Philip K. Dick fan or a fan of just like the thoughtful games in that vein of Gone Home or even the Stanley Parable, not necessarily as funny, but where you just kind of explore – an idea in a world, it's a definite buy it. Definite.
Nice.
If you don't know sci-fi as much, but you're kind of curious about it, or you don't really know much about Philip K. Dick, I still say it's a try it. It really is a very interesting game. And again, we've gotten to really broaden what games are. So, you don't shoot anything, you barely interact with anything. It's still a game. It's an interactive experience that's telling a very, very interesting and kind of mindfuck story.
Yeah.
So I say it's a definite try it if you're a fan of the genre or a fan of Philip K. Dick, but at least try it out. At least try it out, if not buy it outright.
Good stuff. All right, two more games to go over. The first one is called Ironcast, developed by Dreadbit, published by Ripstone. It releases on March 4th for $14.99, or it is already out now for the PS4. Have you played this one? I forget if I got you. I didn't get you a code for this one?
No.
I thought it was this one.
Nine.
All right. Well, it is a mech battler just matching gem puzzle game. It's a very unique game in that it is very strategic in that you need to manage different resources for your mech, your Ironcast. To battle other Ironcast machines or different, they have like steam tanks. There's bigger boss enemies, and the gems aren't. It's not really a gem matching game. The gems are more there to earn the resources for the actual strategic elements of the game. There's four different color gems. One is for ammunition, one is for energy, one is for coolant, and one is for repair. When you do any kind of shooting or energy-using action, it's going to use coolant as well to keep your systems cool. The energy is used mostly for either powering up your shields or making your mech walk. And in between turns, like after a turn, you can power up your shield or your walking speed three levels. After each turn, it comes back to your turn, it drops one level. So you're constantly needing to get energy to refill your shields or to keep walking. Your ammunition, that doesn't use any energy, but of course uses ammo to attack, and it uses coolant. Those, you can direct your attacks towards any of the four components of your enemy, either the two weapons. There's two different weapons. There are the drive capabilities that keep you moving, and then the shielding capabilities, which obviously powers your shield. So if you focus your fire, like, for example, on the drive, you can prevent them from walking, and the walking increases your evasion. So the faster you're walking, the harder you are to hit. If you take out the walking, obviously they're not a moving target anymore. The repair is used for when you are damaged. You can use the repair ability to obviously...
You know, when I play a game, I'm always damaged.
Yeah, I know. Obviously, the repair is used to repair the systems that have been damaged by your opponent's attack. You have to manage your two weapons, your drive, and your shielding, as well as your actual Ironcast hull damage, which you cannot use the repair skill on. And once you can lose a weapon and repair it back to health, but if your hull hits zero, your vehicle explodes, and it's game over.
Well, that makes sense.
And it's permadeath, which means if you blow up, your game is over. You got to start
now,
over.
Can you run away in a battle when you're getting...
No.
Ah, okay.
But once you die, which you will, all the experience that you have earned go towards commendation medals, which you can then use those commendation medals to... purchase upgrades for your next round. Like, you can spend 5 or 10 medals to purchase so that you gain an extra 2% experience, or you gain an extra 2% money in battle, or you can use it to start off with extra health, or you can use it to unlock other generals or Ironcast mechs, because there's four different generals you can use and four different mechs, each with their own abilities. You start the game with only one of each. So it's roguelike in the fact that you're going to die and you kind of need to die a few times. So there is a lot of repetition in going through those first few missions over and over, but it doesn't ever get stale because of the whole gem matching aspect is so randomized.
Okay.
And the way
randomized. So when you die, you can blame it on the game.
And the way the gem matching works is that it isn't just like drag a gem in line three up or whatever. You start at a gem and you can travel in any direction to match up with another of the same color. So if you can go up, down, left, right, or even diagonal, and if you can line up 14 of the same color, you do a 14 gem combo, which not only gives you the 14 resources, but it also gives you a big scrap, which is your money, and experience boost. There are also overdrive gems, which can give you a more powerful attack or a stronger shield deflection. There are also commendation medals that you can randomly find, which are basically wild colors that can be matched with anything. And then there are chain linkers, where if you match up a certain color and then hit a chain linker, you can then go on to a different color and match them up. So there's been times where I've matched up like 20-some gems between colors, combos, linkers, overdrives, and it's pretty awesome to nail a massive combo and have half the board disappear. The game is a lot of fun. It is definitely not for everyone, because as simple as it might look in pictures, it is very complex, but it is worth it if you put the time into it. I would give this one a try it, just because it might not be up your alley. So I would check out a playthrough online, or, you know, watch a Twitch stream or something. If you're into match three games, I would definitely look into more information before jumping into it, because this is not Puzzle Quest.
Eh.
great reply.
Yeah, no, I tried to interrupt you to give you a break, and when you're done, I'm spent. So yeah, one more game and I can go eat dinner.
Yeah, after I blow my nose.
Yeah, we're at that point where it's like, say as much, we'll finish sooner.
Final game to talk about is called Action Hank. Hank, not Hank. H-E-N-K. It is developed
It's so hard to get that across verbally, though.
I know. Developed by Rage Squid, published by Curve Digital. It releases March 4th for $14.99, or March 8th on the PS4. This was actually one of the three games that was up for vote for the free game of the month on PlayStation Plus, which Broforce won. This one lost, so it will be on sale on the PS4. I don't have a final price for it. I want to say it might be like $11.99, but I don't know for sure. It is, you called it a runner game, which isn't...
It's like a runner, yeah.
It's not an auto runner. It is more of a side-scroll racing game, where you're an out of shape former action hero toy figure. it's a weird story. It's funny though, where you have to race through the levels as quick as you can, and to gain speed. It's not about just running as fast as you can. It's about gaining and keeping momentum. And as you're going downhill, you butt slide to gain momentum. And then you have to, you know, jump properly to jump over little blocks or ramps to keep that momentum. You have to time jumps properly. As you get further in the game, it adds things like loops and grappling hooks and all these other little fun little additions and
yeah, like your things. Fun little... things.
I don't know. My brain's starting to melt down. We're over 2 hours. It's stupidly fun. It's stupidly funny. There is a lot of replay value in it because it all comes down to your fastest time, which there's bronze medal, there's silver medal, there's gold medal, and then there's a rainbow medal, which I haven't gotten a single fucking rainbow medal yet because these times to get them are inhuman. So fuck you, Rage Squid, for making these times so goddamn hard to do. Like, there's just some insane times where it comes down to absolute precision.
Oh, yeah, like Wonder Shot. Oh, beat the devs. They did it in 8 seconds. You took 90.
Well, on Wonder Shot, I got close on a bunch of the Wonder Shot ones. With this one, I'm, like, as close as I think I am, it comes down, it literally comes down to hundredths of seconds to improve. And you just get so close and it just feels so far away where you're like, I need a tenth of a second faster. How the fuck do I get a tenth of a second faster? It's just ridiculous. There's also multiplayer, local multiplayer racing, so you could play with your friends, leaderboards so that you can brag about how much better you are than all those other assholes that you're friends with. So it was pretty cool. I know there's only like 40 or so people on the leaderboards right now because it's still early, or it was when I was playing. But when I would get like fifth place, it felt fucking awesome. The game is insanely fun, insanely addictive, an easy buy it in my eyes. Rage Squid did good with this one. And it is absolutely worth checking out. And I think it is a goddamn shame that this lost out to Broforce, because as cool as Broforce is, it's been there, done that. Like, this is, if you're an old school Super Nintendo owner, Uniracers, this is like the new generation of Uniracers, or Unirally if you're European. It's just awesome stuff. Awesome stuff.
I'll have to play it and then tell you how I feel about that, since I played the shit out of Broforce.
It's just, everyone knows what Broforce is. Action Hank is new. It's just, it's something different where it's not,
it's
just
hard to spell
more
correctly.
Shooting. No, it's very easy to spell correctly as long as
Broforce,
you know.
Broforce is not more, just more shooting. You take that back, you son of a bitch.
And then the third game that was in that is Assault Android Cactus, which we did an interview with them a couple of months ago at the Steam release. It's finally releasing on the PS4, and we'll be able to talk about that one more next week.
Yeah, next week, after I've eaten dinner seven
Indeed.
Times.
But, yeah, big thanks again for
that was awesome.
To Hugh for our fantastic interview today. Which, again, I'm very sad we didn't get off topic more, because there was so much we could have talked about. Like, we spent a solid hour and a half talking about the game, which is weird. It's just weird. But music this week, or this episode, not this week. Fuck, we don't do weekly episodes anymore. Music this episode is probably going to be some music from Brigador. I will have to hit up that link that Hugh hooked me up with and see if I could grab a couple of tracks to play.
Yeah, you know, I forgot to ask how many people make fun of his name, like Hugh, or, you know, Hugh Bastard.
I hate you. I really do.